Welcome to the continued podcast adventures of three opinionated guys with mics and too much free time. Strong enough to stop a speeding movie rumor, more powerful than a bad comic book event, able to waste hours of time asking stupid questions to people who have better things to do. It's Dave, Ben, and John. It's Superhero Speak.
Hey, everyone. You're listening to Superhero Speak, and I'm your host, Dave.
And John.
And we have three special guests this episode. We have, I believe, they're a husband and wife team.
Yeah.
Okay, so we have Karen and Alan Tupper. How are you guys doing?
We're doing all right.
I'm doing okay.
And their third mysterious cohort, Havana N, because I don't have a last name on you.
Wayne.
So I'll have to jump in here and be that guy. It's actually Alan Tupper, Carrie Tupper, and Havana Wynn.
Yeah.
Okay.
Perfect.
Cool. So you guys are friends of Troy, who is a good friend of this show. He hooked us up and said that, that we should have you on. So here you are, and you're here to talk about your Project Kamikaze.
Yep.
So
real quick, before we get into anything else, why don't you give the folks at home the elevator pitch?
All right, shall I?
Yep. Sure.
All right. So Kamikaze is a sci-fi thriller comic series. I think Mad Max meets Batman Beyond. Basically follows the story of what happens when the world's first superheroine shows up about 200 years after the world has already ended. We've been running as a webcomic for the last 2 to 3 years. And before that, we were a concept for an animated series. Last year, we went into print with our first Kickstarter campaign to get our first graphic novels printed off. And we are running our second Kickstarter campaign right now. It ends on the 24th of June, and that's to get our second volume printed off, which is going to be 110 pages full color.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. And so our story actually follows our protagonist, and her name is Marcatia. And she lives in a city called Trinity, which our story focuses on. And she lives in the slums with her dad. And basically her whole life she's been able to survive this post-apocalyptic environment by keeping her head low, minding her own business, and just working as a courier to save up money to get her dad and her out of the city. Of course, throughout Volume 1, a series of events unfold which kind of drag her into this this life or death situation, and she has no choice but to take up this alter ego Kamikaze.
Okay, so I'm going to now ask, and Havana gave all of those fine details, I'm going to guess, and I could be completely wrong here, that you're the writer.
I am not.
Oh,
Carrie Tupper is our head writer. Actually, I'm actually the latest, add on to the team.
Nice.
Yeah, so Havana does all the cleanup art for us. So she
does all
the gorgeous character art. She keeps everybody looking on model and well-designed. Alan and I come up with a couple designs ourselves, but we basically hand those over to Havana, and she makes them sing. Alan also does all the backgrounds, and he's also a rough and layout artist, so what'll happen is we sort of work in a kind of an animation process, since Alan and I are actually animators by trade. So Alan will focus on getting, the movement down, the body language right, the basic facial expression, and then Havana comes in and does the cleanups over it that basically makes it look like, everything's on model. From there, I come in and I do the ink and paint. And then it's all composited by Alan, and then Havana does the lettering and graphic design, and it's a team effort.
Good. You guys have been an online webcomic for a while, I guess?
Yes.
Yeah, almost 3 years now.
Okay, so when you decide to do this, now, I've read a whole bunch of online webcomics, user-friendly, Penny Arcade, Bunny, PvP Online, Dominic Deegan and all those. So, and a lot of those guys have been around for over a decade now.
Oh, yeah.
What made you start as a webcomic instead of going straight to, a comic book format?
So that's a great question.
That's a really good question. I think the reason why we started that way is because we actually started out as an animated series project. So we wanted to pitch this as an animated series. So we created the first episode and we did all this sort of stuff, creating the designs and writing everything out. And we pitched it, and a lot of the networks that we talked to loved what they saw, but they were like, okay, you're not Batman, you're not Adventure Time, you're not SpongeBob, you're not Doc McStuffins, where do we put you? And it just sort of came down to, like, you know, they're like, somebody's going to make money on this, but, you know, we need to see that it actually has momentum behind it, that people are actually interested in it. So can you go prove that anime is a thing? And so we just basically said, all right, well, we're not going to ask, you know, for permission to tell our own story. We're just going to tell it online. And we decided as animators, yeah, we can totally make a comic. We know what we're doing, and we're wrong. luckily we've had some great people around us to help us through it. And so we just started creating it as a comic as a way of getting the story out because we were tired of keeping it under wraps.
Right.
And also Go ahead. Also it was a way to kind of validate our approach and see, like, okay, this is a story that resonates with us. Will it resonate with other people? I think at that point when we got that unanimous feedback from networks and producers, we had a choice. We could either pour all of our money and time and energy into trying to animate a very, very, very short animated clip by ourselves, or we could actually do what we focus on and focus on unrolling the story out and trying to see if, is there a fan base for this? Is there readership for this? And we're happy to see, like, 3 years later, we have a very passionate fan base, and that's been really rewarding.
Right, and I think to the original question about why we chose webcomic as opposed to print, part of it was impatience. We had been working on it for about a year and a half as a pitch, and we were just ready to get it out there in the world and get some feedback. And I think part of it was also that the barriers to entry were a lot lower. We weren't at that time we weren't versed really at all in what the comic pitching process was going to be. So and we didn't feel confident that we'd validated the concept enough to be able to just run out to a Kickstarter immediately to get it printed off. off of a speculative idea. So we really wanted to give ourselves the chance to really make sure that we weren't, you know, just blowing smoke beforehand. So we went into the webcomic route as a way of being able to just, you know, week by week, just validate it that way.
You know, it's funny because now that I've met you and this and you've done this, I actually I'm thinking or wondering why more of the creators actually don't go this route. I wonder if a lot of people are stuck in the rut of I have a comic and therefore it must be a book, because there, like I said, there are so many online webcomics, and they do fairly well from what I understand. I mean, either by selling prints or T-shirts or Etsy or whatever, or, you know, or through ads, but they actually, from what I understand, the creators are doing fairly well, and for you, it's perfect for getting you a jumpstart into being able to say, hey, you know, this is how many hits on each page we get. How would you like that in a book form with, you know, with your publisher?
Yeah,
and, you know, I think it's a part of it is people are. I mean, I can't speak for all creators who prefer print, but I think a part of it is fear of releasing stuff for free, maybe.
Yeah.
I mean, there are other fears as well, but that's the one that I jumped.
I think another part of it is, it's, you know, the whole side of the web releasing is, if you're coming at it from a traditional mindset of, you know, let me create a book, it can be a little bit odd because you have to, like, approach it from this, like, weekly publishing schedule. You have to become your own publicist. You have to become your own, you know, publisher. You have to run your own website in some cases. And in some cases, people just want to be creating the book and not have to worry at all about that part. And I think I've been seeing sort of a shift in the mentality of a lot of indie creators where they are starting to move more towards the website of things. or at least they're having to onboard a lot more of the roles of, like, they have to be their own publicist, they have to be their own publisher, because that's kind of what the drop in printing costs has kind of done to democratize the indie scene. You just have to take those roles on by default.
Yeah, and I think another part of it is also that, while I understand that a lot of creators I could understand why a lot of creators might not want to go the webcomic route, because it's something that is a slow burn. You have to have it's hard to get that first, following. And believe it or not, most webcomics aren't successful at all. Most webcomics don't make it past 30 pages.
Wow.
They stop creating. And that's actually a pretty, like, if you can make it over 30 pages, usually you're going to be able to keep going. So it's also, again, a very saturated market. So being able to create something that people are consistently coming back to can be difficult. And just getting people to know about it, because, you're talking about PvP, Penny Arcade, all of XKDC and all these other comics, like, they're great. But they're also gags. They're like comedy driven, whereas Kamikaze is actually narrative driven. So that also gives us a little bit of a harder edge, because it's not something that's so easily shareable. Mm-hmm. You can see a little like 5-panel comic about what it's like to deal with depression during the day, and people will share their living daylights out of it because they relate to it. But when you've got a narrative comic, it's harder to find ways. It's harder for people to get to the point where they're like, oh, I can relate to this. And then by the time that page comes and maybe they'll share it, it's sort of like, well, what's the context to this, because mm-hmm. nobody's actually read the rest of that comic. So it's, it can be difficult, but it's very rewarding when it works well.
Did you find that it was a slow burn that, like, I mean, when you started putting it out, because I assume that there's a difference between putting out a webcomic and then putting out a book, because in the one hand, as you said, there's a slow burn where you have to get more people coming to the site and getting interested in the storyline. You're putting out maybe once a week, mm-hmm. but mm-hmm. that is less of an outlay of cash than finding a publisher and actually publishing a physical book, right?
Right.
I mean, it depends. I mean, in some cases, the webcomic route can, it definitely eats up a lot of time. One thing we did when we released, we actually released a sort of a prologue. It was about basically a 23-ish page long prologue, which was actually to solve a problem where we had we were brand new, so we wanted to make sure we had something which was going to be shareable as one big chunk. And we also had a problem where our prologue did not feature our main character until like the last page. So we felt like in order to prevent people from having to wait, on a weekly posting schedule, half a year to see our main character, we decided, all right, we're just going to drop it all now. And then we'll pick up our weekly schedule past that point. Past that point, yeah, it has been kind of a war of inches. You do have to, basically, grind out, month after month of posts and hope that that's going to lead to, an eventual gain in users. And, you do eventually start to pick up users along the way, and they tell folks, and, it becomes a virtuous cycle. But, yeah, you definitely do have to kind of keep the faith in the beginning, because you're just one, one voice in a very noisy internet.
Yes, I totally understand that point. There's, like you said, same thing with podcasts. There's many podcasts that don't get past the first, 3-4 months. And like you said, and a lot of it is, I think, on the internet is consistency and sticking with it.
Yeah.
And then eventually all the other stuff will fall away, and as long as you're keep putting out something quality every week, every day, whatever, people are going to find it,
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I was kind of curious, backing up a little bit, both Alan and Carrie, you said your background was in animation. Is that how you guys met?
Yeah. We met in college when we were in the same animation program, and we sort of got to know each other the first day a little bit, and then within 2 weeks we were dating, and ever since then we've kind of been attached at the hip. So We were a, I don't know, a fixture among the animation halls.
Do you, does that ever, is that a strength or does it get in the way sometimes of working together?
I'd say a bit of both.
Yeah, I think, you know, like all potent things, it's a double-edged sword. Like when it was working well, I mean, it's great to have, you know, a confidant and a coworker who's completely on the same page as you on what the project is. And a lot of the early development of Kamikaze happened because Carrie and I just had a sort of a story football that we threw back and forth to each other on like road trips and stuff. So just having sort of like that de facto co-conspirator thing was really great. You know, there are times though where, you know, the proximity can kind of get to you and you're like, I just need like 10 days of breathing room. We're not talking about this project. And so that can be an issue. But yeah, I think on the whole, you know, the benefits definitely outweigh the negatives as long as communication is, you know, is prioritized.
Yeah, and we try to.
I really don't know how to do it.
Yeah.
I don't get it still. I've been working with them for 4 years. I'm like, I don't get it. It's great that it works out, but
I think a lot of it is also just knowing what your priorities are. So when it comes to our projects or our relationships, Alan and I have a very, you know, an understanding that our relationship ultimately matters more. So if a project is getting in the way of us being able to, you know, be married and still love each other, then, you know, that's something we have to give up. And it can be a little scary when you actually sort of say it out loud. but it's also something that, you know, I know that Alan's there for me and that if it came between me and, you know, a project that we're working on, to know that he'd care more for me than he would about the project, that means a lot.
And how does Havana feel about that?
I guess my job here is dependent on whether you guys fight or not, I guess. they're great. Like, I think Carrie and Alan, I definitely respect. I mean, they're a great couple. Like, they work things out, and I've seen them handle conflicts before. It's, you know, it's definitely rare. Like, and I'm glad that they are able to strike that balance. It's never really been, like, a huge source of conflict for us.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. It's never caused any friction, so that's good.
Right.
Well, it's a good thing because it'd be two against one, right?
Right? No? Yes, you get me.
Yeah. So, let's see. Havana, what's your story? Because I'm looking at the art here, and you guys mentioned in the beginning Batman Beyond, and that's the first thing I thought when I saw it.
Oh, great.
So, I mean, it's just, I guess, the lines and how the faces are drawn.
Yeah.
It kind of looks like I mean, it's not as crisp as that. Maybe something else like Boondocks, too, maybe.
Yeah. So we actually, you know, we do mention Batman Beyond when we're pitching, but in reality, it's really a culmination of a bunch of different TV shows. Like, for example, I think when I joined back in 2012, I'm the black sheep of the group. I did not have an art degree. I've been drawing since I was three. I've always been an animation fan my whole life. I wound up getting, I changed my major like four times in college, but I wound up getting,
welcome to the club.
Yes, I wound up getting a degree in international affairs, and I work in software. I have a lot of different interests, but my lifelong interest has always, I mean, I've always had a love for animation. And even if I wasn't going to work in that industry, I've always wanted to, like, there must be some way I could get involved. And, I got introduced to Carrie and Alan through a mutual friend, and it was just like immediately we hit it off because the three of us have such a passion for animation, and I wasn't used to interacting with other hardcore animation fans. I only knew the casual fans, not the hardcore ones. But, like, I think with Carrie and Alan and I, we shared one vision together, and that vision always pushes us forward in this project. And that vision is that animation can be a medium for anybody, regardless of age. It's not just a kid thing. Like, I think that there is a generation of people, like, who grew up with the cartoons from the 80s and 90s, and they're used to animation as a medium. They don't see it as just a kid's thing. That's why we have, like, such a huge market in anime, with mature themes and, adult storytelling. But when you look at the kinds of animated TV shows being produced in the States, most of the time, like, anything that's geared towards adults is going to be comedy. And while I love Archer, I love Family Guy and all of that, I want to see, like, an animated drama for people our age.
Yeah.
And I think that's why our style takes from, like, Batman Beyond, G.I. Joe Renegades, Aeon Flux, Young Justice. It's from a bunch of things.
It's kind of sad because we've gone backwards in the last few years. We went from stuff like the original Teen Titans and the Bruce Timm series and all that, and we've gone to Teen Titans Go. And
like, what the hell is that shit?
I have no idea.
The original Teen Titans was so good.
Yeah, and even like Comedy Central, or not Comedy Central, Cartoon Network has been going backwards. Some of their original series, like even Steven Universe and, you know, a few of the others that actually had very, very, some quite adult themes and very complex plots. And now, from what I've read, they're going backwards too to more banal stuff, I guess you could say.
Yeah. I don't know. It's like, I'm not sure why that happens, because I know for a fact that there is an audience for that stuff. I'm not sure if it's just because there hasn't been enough animated drama type series or something like that. I don't know. It's one of the reasons why we had to divert from the animation route for a little bit was because, you know, a lot of the networks we were talking to, they were wanting things for boys aged 5 to 8, you know,
8
or
to 12.
Yes, that's it. 8 to 12.
Mm-hmm. 8 to 12. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So when you're thinking of boys 8 to 12, within animation you have specific target audiences that the networks want to grab, and boys 8 to 12 tends to be the ones that bring in the most money because they can sell the most merchandise and they can get more advertisers for them. So that's when you're talking about stuff like Adventure Time, Gravity Falls.
Gravity Falls, yeah.
In some cases, Steven Universe, so that might be considered gender neutral. And then you've also got like Young Justice and Legend of Korra and Avatar The Last Airbender were all considered, you know, boys 8 to 12. That's actually part of the reason why Korra was almost not Korra, because, you know, the network's executives were sort of like, well, we can't have an 8 to 12, you know, show for boys that stars a girl. That just doesn't happen. And Korra almost didn't happen because of that.
They didn't learn from Avatar, the first series, that, you know, I mean, didn't they realize that the writers had already bucked the trends in one series? And if that hadn't happened, we wouldn't have had Kurosami. Then what would we have done?
Exactly.
Yeah, it's hard because it's sort of like when you're talking to an executive, it's hard because in animation there's this adage that it's not an art, it's a business. But it's also flipped, and it is an art, but not a business. So you're constantly balancing those sides. So executives and producers are the people who are thinking in money-wise. These are the people thinking, okay, this is what needs to be, this is what's going to sell, this is what's going to make the company money so we can continue to make art. Versus this, when you're talking with the artists, it's sort of like, this is what the art that we're going to create, which is going to, you know, make the money, and you just need to listen to us. And it's a constant battle and butting of heads, but sometimes things work. Like, I don't know how Rebecca Sugar managed to get Steven Universe as wonderful and even just created as she did. But it's magical. And the fact that, you know, she keeps getting past censorships with a lot of her stuff is just absolutely amazing. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah,
I have a lot of respect for her.
Yeah, there have been a lot of writers that have done that. Tartakovsky, right?
Mm-hmm. So, yes.
Yeah, I mean, like guys like that, or who else? There's been quite a few in recent years, and they get stuff passed, and I don't understand the if the 8-12 demographic made the most money, then why are we on season 7 of My Little Pony? Really?
Exactly. And why is My Little Pony selling into the 18-25 market so well?
in some cases that's because the Hub was one of the few networks that actually realized the potential of that non-core audience. What happened to things like Young Justice is that the network saw this shift in demographics of their audience towards something older or not intentional. Like it was like a female shift in the audience, and they panicked because they didn't know how to woo the advertisers that would bring in the advertising money, or they didn't think that they could sell toys without cannibalizing their own market. So they panicked and said, all right, so we need to pull the plug because we don't know how to market to these folks. Yeah. The Hub, very, in my opinion, very wisely realized the fact that, okay, no, this is where our audience is, and this is not, it's not where we planned it was, but this is where it is. We can still serve our core audience while, figuring out ways of making money off of this unintentional audience.
Yeah.
A lot of the problems do tend to manifest around the fact that there's a lot of risk aversion when it comes to the budgeting and the tracking of success of shows, and that does tend to lead to a lot of hesitancy in networks to make safe choices as best as they think that they can define it. Because they don't feel like they can afford to make a bad move. The irony, of course, is that they are making moves which, from an audience perspective, feel kind of subpar.
Yeah.
So, along those lines, what are your favorites? I mean, did anything inspire you for the writing that you're doing now? Or is the writing you're doing now because of an irregular shaped cloud or a burning bush or something or a dream that came to you?
That's a great question.
As far as the writing goes on my end, inspiration comes from actually a lot of television, but not animated television. A lot of it's live action television. I really love Game of Thrones and pretty much anything George R. R. Martin. And while I understand he has a certain habit in his writing, I tend to try to steer away from that bit. I really like politically motivated storytelling. I like stuff that is really, very heavy and character-driven, and character-driven narratives and all that sort of stuff. So if I am really inspired by anything, it's shows like Sherlock, it's shows like Luther, Game of Thrones, to some extent, a lot of Neil Gaiman's work as well is, yep. Inspiring for me. And, of course I was a Harry Potter nut growing up. So J.K. Rowling in some cases as well.
So is it the, obvious, trait of, Martin that you would avoid?
Oh, killing everybody?
Yeah,
I was gonna say, because I'm on page I don't know, and I don't want to hear that.
No, we tend to show a good deal of restraint in that regard.
Yeah, but, the first chapter is can be a little hard, but I promise if somebody dies within our work, we don't want to just have them die for no reason. And that's one of my biggest gripes with what George R. R. Martin does, is that often he kills his characters as for shock value rather than narrative need. And when it comes to killing off characters, at least in my view, it's to make sure that it's done with if somebody has to die within Kamikazes, they're going to go out guns blazing and it's going to be glorious, you know, like as at least if that's what I'd like to do. But it also has to make narrative sense. And if it's not making narrative sense, then why do it? You know?
Mm-hmm. And, along those lines, are you going to go the, you know, traditional comic book route where they could come back or, once they're gone?
Oh no. When they're dead, they're dead. Okay. Like, no, there's none of that.
I hate, that is one of my pet peeves in comic books and stories and stuff. The fake death.
I agree. Like, the fake death is something that drives me insane.
Like, I loved Sailor Moon growing up, but, I mean, I was 12, and by season so-and-so, I'm like, that bitch ain't.
Someone's dead. There's no dying.
She'll come back. It's
right, and I feel like, you know, in some ways, like, doing those kind of character deaths, not only does it, you know, cheapen the reaction for your long-time readers, it can make things really confusing for new readers, which I think might be one of the reasons why we're in such a convoluted place as a comic book industry, where, you know, you have, you know, a thousand different storylines of the same character. And you'll have character deaths and then someone else taking up the mantle and then that character retiring because the other character is surprised back to life or not corrupted or something. Right. And it just creates this, you know, this labyrinth for new readers where there's like, where should I even start with this, you know, with the storyline?
Yeah.
So we're very big fans of concise stories. We have introduced sort of a short anthology spin-off series where we've kind of allowed ourselves to skip ahead to the superhero bits, and we've been bringing in other creators as a way of kind of fleshing out the narrative voice of the story and really giving other writers and creators a chance to play around in this world we've built. But we still kind of view those as like very separate, you know, episodic encapsulated stories, whereas the main story definitely has a beginning and an end that we really want to adhere to.
Right. Oh, so this does have an end.
Oh, yeah. Well,
it does, yes.
And what happens at the end? I mean, is this going to be something?
Just give it away all right now.
No. I didn't mean that. I didn't mean that. Sorry, it just slipped. No spoilers. No, but what I meant was like, okay, so you just mentioned that you have other writers that you're allowing to play in your sandbox, for right. lack of a better term. Yeah. So does that mean that when you finish with this story, you're going to go back and tell another story, or do you have other worlds that you want, that you're thinking of building?
So I think we've got, just over the course of working together as a team, we've come up with some other ideas and we haven't quite had the time yet to start exploring them too deeply, but I think we're excited about the chance of getting in and exploring those. Beyond that, we think it'd be really cool to go in and explore other, you know, aspects of this world that we've built. Honestly, the amount of material we have for the main storyline would probably keep us busy for the foreseeable future for quite some time.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's no end in sight.
It's on the map. It's just you can't see it.
Yeah.
And speaking of other creators, as I mentioned in the beginning, we were introduced through Troy, and he said that you guys had an involvement with the Terminal Project.
Yeah, so it's actually I'm doing a written piece for the Terminal Project myself in one of the next issues, and it's going to be a sort of cyberpunk sci-fi thing, and I'm really excited about it. I don't want to give out too much about it because I want to make sure it's approved.
Okay.
But that is my genre, and I'm sticking to it. So.
All right, I just want to make sure we mentioned it. Yeah.
Yeah. It's I'm really excited about it, and I have to have my final script in by August 1st. So.
Chop chop.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, cool. Well, and it's just written, no art to it, or
we are waiting to figure out who the artist is going to be.
Oh, okay.
The thing about the Terminal Project is that, you know, it's an anthology series where
right.
You know, everybody's sort of donating their time, and then, you know, the book gets made and all that sort of stuff. So it's really just trying to figure out if there's an artist who wants to do it, and if we can find somebody for it, then we do. And if not, well, I got a great script, so.
That means that you'll have a bunch of different art styles, though, going forward.
Yeah, yeah. But it's not necessarily bad.
Right.
No,
not at all. Cool. And so what is the let's talk a little bit about your Kickstarter. So you have a Kickstarter going now. What is the goal? I know to get the book out and print it, but I meant, you know,
right.
Money-wise, yeah. And what are some of the prizes, or what do you call it? The
rewards.
Rewards, yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. So we're trying to raise $12,400. As of right now, we are 71% funded, so we've got a little over $8,800 and over 10 days to go. So I think we're chugging along at a pretty good rate. The primary goal is to print volume 2, which is the sort of the second episode storyline. Plus, we're also getting one of the anthology comics, the Wall Tale spinoff stories, in print as well, as sort of a co-equal goal that we're getting done. On top of that, like a lot of our goals are our reward tiers are aimed at new readers. So we have lots of reward tiers where you can get both volume 1 and volume 2 as sort of a bundle. We also have some really cool high level tiers that include things like commissions. I think we've only got one commission pack left.
Oh, cool.
And even like walk on cameos if you're willing to, you know, to let us have you in the world, and we'll try not to kill you.
Or yeah. We can try. Kill you if you want to die.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. We do ask that people specify the peril level that they're comfortable with for their cameo.
I'm just saying, if I got to be a cameo in the comic, I want to get, like, peppered with bullets. I'm just saying.
But, yeah, I think one of the coolest goals we've got, rewards, is a donor pack, where if you want to get a copy of the comics donated to a library or a kids hospital, you can do that. You can basically specify in your pack that you want your books donated there. You'll also get a copy of the books sent to you, but you'll also get both volume 1 and volume 2 shipped to the nonprofit of your choice.
Oh, cool.
Because we want to give folks an opportunity to get those books out there, because we realize that that's an important thing. We've also got some tiers for reward packs for comic shops if they want to get both volume 1 and volume 2 to get stocked up, and those prices are at wholesale. And we've also got stickers and lapel pins and all sorts of fun stuff. We've even added in the digital rewards pack that we're giving out as part of Volume 1's Kickstarter. That you get that automatically if you get anything that has a digital reward pack for Volume 2.
Oh, cool. Sounds like you got a lot of good perks, so definitely people should go check that out.
Yeah, absolutely. We'd love to have you.
Yes, and can I just, like, share something I'm really excited about today? Like,
no.
One of my...
I mean, yes.
excuse you. so, like, my favorite musician on YouTube, like, backed us over the weekend, and that, like, just made me squee. I was so excited. Yeah, his name is Jonathan Young, and he has a whole YouTube channel where he does covers of, like, rock and metal covers of different songs from animated TV shows, animes, TV, and, like, other, like, mainstream pop type of songs. But he does them all in, like, a different genre. Anyways, I'm a big fan of him, and we saw his name pop up on Kickstarter, and that was really exciting.
Fantastic.
Yay!
A metal version of Hellfire from Hunchback of Notre Dame, and it's
pretty baller.
It's cathartic.
It's too bad you don't have a singing cameo pack, right?
I know.
we'll have to remember that one for next time.
Yeah.
So, random question. for Carrie, because your icon has the image of you with the, shall we say, the...
vomiting rainbows, yeah.
The rainbow spew, yeah. Now, I know that that's a meme somewhere, but the only other place I've really seen that used over and over again was on a is on a YouTube channel called Anime America.
Uh-huh.
But is that where you got it from? I just had to ask. Probably not.
No, the icon that I have was actually an icon I found through Tumblr, and I was shocked at how much it actually looked like me. So I was just like, nah, this is pretty accurate. So I just sort of saved it and used it as my my Skype icon. But it's it is not what that – I unfortunately don't vomit rainbows. In fact, I try not to vomit at all. but I don't think we need to talk that much about my gastrointestinal issues.
No.
And that ends the random question portion of this interview.
We're
really excited to be launching the second Kickstarter. It's been a little bit of a journey, because when we did our first Kickstarter, we really weren't sure how much support we were going to get. We really got blown away by that. And we're really excited that, you know, now that we're, you know, now that we have basically been a year with books, that's been a really surreal experience, because beforehand, you know, we were just, you know, we were just on the web. So, like, every time we went to a convention, you know, we were just, you know, we were just basically handing out business cards and, like, saying, oh, I hope they'll go and read it. I hope they'll go and read it.
Right.
But it's really, really useful to have a printed copy of your book that you can say, no, here's what I'm working on. I am not, in fact, a crazy person. You know, here's, in fact, the comic I work on.
I carry a copy of Volume 1 in my purse. Because I do, you know, when people say, ask me what do I do, I'll tell them I work on a comic, and I see their eyes, like, immediately glaze over, but then I whip out the comic, and they actually see, like, the art's good, it looks legit, and they'll flip through it. Oh my god, you're, like, for real.
It's also good for stopping muggings, right? Because, you know, it is a...
It is a graphic novel. It does weigh 13 ounces, so you can technically use it as a bludgeon.
Oh, yes. A good idea. I did not think about that. But so, yes, multi-use.
Or a very large throwing star.
Oh, my God.
Ooh, ow. So here's a question that for the Kickstarter stuff, because we've talked to a lot of people that are trying to use or have used Kickstarter as a way of getting their stuff funded. You did. This is your second one, right? So
yes.
there was a first one, and were you as well known when you started that one? And how did it go?
well known.
So we did have a fan base. It's not as big as it is now. I would say maybe we were around 1,200 followers on Facebook at the time. So we didn't have, you know, zero followers, but we also weren't, like, super well-known either. Kickstarter, we chose eventually to do the Kickstarter as not only a way to get pre-orders for the book or, you know, fund the book, but also to market, you know, use it as a marketing opportunity for Kamikaze as a whole as well. Because, like, we hired someone to do our video. We crafted, did our pitch of the story and characters and everything. Kickstarter has been a really powerful platform just to get people to know more about the project.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the funding is, it works, right? I mean, it's worth it.
Yeah. I mean, I think as long as you have, you've built a solid case for what you're trying to get made, and there is sort of a bit of an art and science to building your page and your pitch, so that you're being coherent and compelling. But I think if you've got a clear vision of what you're trying to do, and you're willing to put in the muscle work to almost get out there every day and you know, almost do, you know, sort of the you know, please take a look at my books, my books, you know, page, and you know, building that hype and building the awareness, And you're also willing to have spent a little bit of time beforehand to, like we were saying, kind of build up a fan base or a just even some sort of a group or a tribe of folks that you can kind of turn to and say, hey, you kind of know what my work is like. Could you go take a look at this and maybe consider, you know, tossing a couple of dollars my way? Right. I think those are really important things to making sure your Kickstarter succeeds on the funding stage.
A couple things we did in the beginning was we consulted a couple of Kickstarter veterans that we knew personally, just to get their thoughts on what went well for them. Well, we definitely did our research. Like, we picked out really successful Kickstarters that we saw in the comic space, but we also picked out some ones that didn't go so well. And the three of us would actually sit down and dissect the hell out of each one, like, what works, what doesn't work, what can we do better. It's really kind of analyzing why one might be more attractive than the other. And not only that, we took out a calendar and actually plotted out and came up with a strategy on how we were going to roll out the content that we were going to post, marketing-wise, content that we were going to post on Facebook, Twitter, our Tumblr, et cetera. I mean, we mapped it all out. Like, there was a lot of, I would say maybe 3 months of work before we actually launched Kickstarter.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
So I have a question, going back to what you were saying when you were shopping this around to networks originally. Mm-hmm. Know, they said, obviously, you're, what was it, 8 to 12 year old boys and, basically, they didn't want a female-led story because that wouldn't attract boys. Do you feel now with the success of Wonder Woman a little more elated and, like, ready to take on the world? Like, hey, look, a female superhero can work.
I think Havana has feels about that. I'm not sure.
A little bit.
Yeah, I think we're going to be really we're going to be heading back to do some more more animation pitching later this year. And I'm really excited to see how the climate has changed, not only because of things like Wonder Woman and the really positive response that Black Panther, just the trailer dropping, has been getting. But also just how things have evolved over the last few years with regards to you know, better representation, with regards to platforms like Netflix really coming in and dominating the space. And also with regards to, you know, things like YouTube really rising to prominence as sort of an alternate delivery method. When we were pitching last time, the networks are all kind of clustered around things like Netflix and YouTube, and they were kind of scratching their heads and saying, "Well, there's clearly people watching stuff here. How do we get involved with that?" And it'll be very interesting to go back there with something like Kamikaze now with, you know, hopefully two books under our belt and, you know, a fan base and say, hey, you know, all those things that you're seeing, you know, that you seem to like that are making money out here, we've kind of got a good mixture of them here. Would you be interested? I'm really excited about that possibility because it felt like when we were going – when we were pitching earlier the consensus was that it was an exciting idea, but it was an idea which was the time wasn't right for it. And if I was going to say, you know, that now feels like a better time, I would say yes.
Definitely.
Cool.
Yeah, and like the thing with TV, and correct me if I'm wrong, Alan and Carrie, because you guys know about this, but the thing about TV is sometimes they're very – not only are they risk-averse, but they're very reactive. So at the time when we were pitching, a lot of the most popular things coming out were Adventure Time, like Over the Garden Wall, The Regular Show, these short little episodic kids shows. And at the time, like, they were even asking, like, we pitched them our Kamikaze, and they weren't necessarily interested, but they were interested in, like, oh, well, the art looks really great. Do you guys have anything that's 11 minutes long, that's episodic, that can be marketed towards boys in that age range? And, you know, we had to kind of turn them away because we didn't have anything at the time. But it was funny because the reason why they were shopping around for that stuff is because they're reacting to the popularity of some of these other shows, like at the time, Over the Garden Wall and Adventure Time and everything. So I'm hoping that, you know, since then, I mean, think of the movies that have come out just in the past 3 years. I mean, everyone goes crazy over Furiosa from Mad Max.
Yeah.
People love the hell out of Rey from The Force Awakens. People went to see Wonder Woman, right? Mm-hmm. And I think, I mean, maybe it's optimistic of me, but I think you guys are right in that. I think there is a change of attitude. I'm hoping that, you know, maybe the timing was not right back then, but the timing could be right now.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah, I definitely hope so. That's, you know, I think, again, it's, I think Alan said it, it's just about more representation.
Yeah.
You know, cool.
And pitching itself is hard. I mean, think about, like, SpongeBob, Venture Brothers, Stranger Things. Those are really popular now, but they took 7 to 10 years to pitch.
Yeah, that's true.
So we got to just hang in there. We're the little kitty cat on the tree branch.
You're adorable, man.
Hanging on for dear life.
Yeah.
Just us and our Kickstarter.
Yeah.
Yes. Cool.
So you go to conventions, right?
Yeah. Yes.
And what's it like at the conventions? Do you find a bunch of this is a two-part question. Do you find that you're finding fans at the conventions, and what do you go to the conventions for besides work? Like, what are the things what are the things that interest you at the conventions these days?
People don't work at conventions.
Okay.
So I'm like the one who does anything besides work at conventions.
Havana's trying to get us to be more social.
So, yeah, so, you know, absolutely, conventions are a fantastic way to find new fans.
Yes.
We really, like, even before we really had the web comic, you know, more than, like, maybe, you know, like, we think we had just released, like, the prologue, but we just made a commitment that we were going to start doing conventions. We knew we were going to be eating the cost of those for a long time. But we knew that it was going to be one of the best ways for us to interface with potential readers and turn them into fans, because, you know, as great as the web is at being able to just kind of put your content up and have, you know, someone in Germany look at it, and you as the publisher not having to pay extra for the privilege of someone in Germany seeing it, it's not that great at making the personal connection. And I think a lot of creators failed to realize how important that can be, how steady a connection that can make.
Right.
And I think a lot of our early growth was as we were reaching out to people at conventions. Carrie recently got stopped in the grocery store by someone who saw the kamikaze patch on her shoulder and had a freak out fan moment.
Nice.
Because
they had met us at MomoCon and become a fan. And yeah, so we definitely we run a table at the conventions. We're handing out business cards. Now we're selling books and prints. And we also do a lot of panels at conventions. We do a lot to reach out to the various conventions and say, hey, if you're looking for you know someone to talk about, you know, web comics, character design, pitching, Kickstarters, you know, we've created, you know, talks about those things. We're more than happy to sit down and share that knowledge, because it's something that, you know, people value, and if we can be helpful, that only, you know, helps build the space, and, you know, it also has the nice add-on effect that it makes us look good. But, you know, we do try to be very active in conventions, and we try to reach out in pretty much every way we can, because we really do value them as a really solid way of building a fan base.
Okay. But if you could, you know, unlock the chain and get away from the desk, what would you go? I mean, what, because, you know, it's like, I understand the work thing, because when I go into a convention now, it's like, if I don't, I feel naked if I don't have a microphone attached to me.
Yeah.
But, So I don't get to go to all the panels I want because I'm too busy scaring up interviews. So, but if you could do that, what would you go for? Like, what's your fan base? What's your fandom, I should say?
Oh, that's a good question. I need to think of this a little bit.
Really?
Well, yeah.
Star Trek, Star Wars, anything, anime?
So I grew up as a Trekkie. My mom was a Trekkie, and the infection has been passed down through the bloodline to me. beyond that, I'm a big fan of Ghost in the Shell. I am also a bit into Star Wars, though I do tend to favor Trek a little bit more than Star Wars. Let's see. I'm a relatively big fan of animes that are doing a solid job that aren't just like fan bait. So I do tend to really like. I used to love Trigun. That was one of my big artistic inspirations when I was starting to come at the art for Kamikaze. It's all over the place. But yeah, I tend to be a fan of classic sci-fi, stuff like Star Trek, stuff like Ghost in the Shell, where it's having lots of fun with like a cyberpunk universe. I'm a bit of a gamer, but not too incredibly good at any gaming. So I like to watch over the shoulders of better gamers, as they're doing a much better job, doing the thing that I am moderately okay at doing. But aside from that, I love wandering around, like the artist alley and just like taking a look at what's out there. Generally speaking, I don't go to conventions with an awful lot of spending cash, so I generally tend to be that jerk who's just like, oh yeah, this looks fantastic. Let me take a business card and never get back to you. but yeah, so that's me. I'm that jerk at the convention.
Yeah.
What about you? What about the other two? What about you two?
Go ahead, Carrie.
No, I just said go. You go.
Fine. All
right. She wants time to think. That's why.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I actually go to conventions to have fun. So.
Really? How does that work?
So I go okay. So I'm also the black sheep in that I'm very much an extrovert, and crowds give me more energy. So I get really hyper.
Oh, a psychic vampire. Okay.
Yes, exactly. I love going to like all the little parties and stuff. I just love hanging out with people and meeting new people at conventions. As far as like fandoms I'm a part of, most recently, I really love seeing all the Steven Universe cosplayers and everything. I'm trying to think of panels. Like at Dragon Con a couple of years ago, I really enjoyed the science panel, or the science track. That was really cool. We got to see some robot action. I'm going to fuck up like telling the story, but we got to see some like 17-year-old who built some sort of fusion reactor thing in his basement, and he actually had it there at Dragon Con.
Oh, wow.
That I'm sounds really, awesome.
Yeah.
And dangerous.
We got to hear from a panel of, like, people who work at NASA. That was really cool. But aside from that, like, I love older animes, primarily from the early 2000s and late 90s. Cowboy Bebop is like my top favorite. I love Revolutionary Girl Utena. Sailor Moon's like a favorite, but mostly for nostalgic reasons. Ghost in the Shell. Well, most recently, I really like Attack on Titan, Death Note. Parasite is a really good one. If you like
Parasite.
Horror. Yep. Yeah, horror, macabre, gory type of anime. And then I like, of course I love anime. Disney, Don Bluth, like all of it. Just anything. I'm mostly working throughout the day, but then at night I like to go to like the little raves and the hotel parties and run around and cause mayhem. So there's all that.
Yeah. As far as inspirations for me, I feel kind of boring in comparison to Alan and Havana.
And see, that's why I needed to go last.
I'm sorry. As far as inspirations go, for me, I grew up pretty sheltered. So I was only allowed to really watch Disney movies or I didn't really get into anime of any kind until I was in like the eighth grade. That's when I started seeing Sailor Moon for the first time. That's when I started seeing things like Inuyasha, which I was a huge fan of.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
I think a lot of it was just because, like, I feel like my taste in anime is very basic because because I got into it so late, and also because it was something so new to me. And when you're growing up on things like, you know, Wishbone and,
What's wrong with Wishbone?
No, it's just like that. I was watching that like for a really long time. Wishbone and Salty the Bible stories and like.
What the hell is that?
It is an actual. It's a thing. Don't look it up.
You're going back to Davy and Goliath.
Yeah, it's like, yeah. Like, okay, Adventures and Virtues was another thing that I would watch. But yeah. It was a lot of PBS. I don't know. I feel like when I got to anime, it was everything was so new, like the storytelling, you know, methods, the metaphors, the way they worked their narrative structures, the characterizations. It was just something so different from what you'd find on, you know, afternoon PBS, you know, stuff.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
and I feel like that's why my taste was so basic back then. But as I got older, Alan has introduced me to. He got me into sci-fi. I was huge into Harry Potter when I was a kid. I actually read a lot more books when I was a kid than watched TV. So I was that creepy little 8-year-old that had, you know, books on paranormal events and like, you know, folklore and monsters and, you know, really old fairy tales and things like that. So I feel like a lot of my inspirations just the things that I like come from that. But Alan, again, has sort of injected those sci-fi elements and broadened my horizons on that front.
Cool.
So,
I have the corruptor in chief.
Yeah. So I will say Batman was a huge thing for me. So the first time I saw Batman the Animated Series, I was blown away.
Oh, everybody was at that point.
I was so blown away. And I remember one of the first episodes I saw was one that was a tribute to Frank Miller's Batman Returns, I think. And it had Carrie Kelly in it.
Yes.
And I remember thinking to myself, like, well, not even thinking to myself, oh my God, she's got red hair and glasses and her name is Carrie. And oh my God, this is so cool. And then I'd go to school and people are like, oh, you're full of it. Like, I was like there's a Robin named Carrie and she has glasses and red hair. And, you know, they thought I was full of it.
Oh.
And I couldn't find an action figure of Carrie Kelly. And my mom was just like, I don't understand who this person is. And I don't know why you're a Batman doll, but you're not getting a Batman doll because that's for boys. So
all right.
It was, I ended up getting, my cousin ended up taking pity on me and gave me his Batman action figure. So I put that in my backpack and take that to school with me.
All right. So now I need to ask, how old were you when that show came out?
What, Batman the Animated Series?
Yeah.
When I started watching it, I was in the fifth grade, but that was, it had been on for a while.
Oh God, I feel old.
you feel old. Jeez.
So there was no way though at 10 years old that you were going to go out and read The Dark Knight Returns because.
I didn't even know I didn't know that comics outside of what you read in the newspaper were a thing when I was younger. So when I found, again, when I found manga and anime, it was like, oh, this whole new world. It was, and I think a lot of anime and manga influences have actually sort of crept into our, the way that we do things. Especially within Kamikaze, like there's moments where we have these, I love what Miyazaki talks about in one of his interviews where he says that there's a there's something that you don't see a lot in animation or Western movies, and it's sort of like, you know, you have this, you always have to have, you know, thing after thing after thing after thing after thing, you know, coming at you. So, you know, things are exploding and everything's going on at once. Is there's not a time to, like, take a moment and sink in what's going on. So he was talking about, you know, if you clap, it's sort of the, you know, you clap and it's sort of that silence, you know, in the midst of that, that you need in order to, like, reorient and understand, you know, this is the gravity of the situation or this is the narrative importance of it. And, I think we try to reflect that within Kamikaze, but, I don't know. I'm not sure if we're exactly, you know, we're exactly, you know, super great at it, but it's something we definitely strive for.
Well, Samurai Jack does that very well.
Yeah.
The moment and, you know, just to let things sink in and to tell a narrative story by having no verbal communication at all. Just,
yeah,
you know, just the looks on their faces and whatever. It's,
yeah, that's actually one of the reasons why. Oh, that's another Balto. When I was a kid, I loved Balto, and I realized recently when I rewatched it, like, the first act is, like, constant, like, you know, talking. But as you go through further through the story and the movie, it just gets quieter and quieter and quieter. Like, most of the end of that movie is, like, pure silence. Nobody talks.
Yeah. The Nostalgia Critic just did a review of Balto, like, a couple of months ago. And he said the same thing.
I haven't watched it. Really? I need to watch that.
Yeah, we've actually had a chance to run into him a couple of times at MomoCon, and he's a pretty fantastic guy.
So cool.
We even managed to get a photo of him holding the prototype for our first book, and it's a mighty struggle for me every day not to use that photo shamelessly to promote the book.
Do it.
Which is something that Doug Walker would appreciate, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly.
Actually, you guys, I saw it on your Facebook, Carrie, and you've mentioned it once or twice. What is MomoCon?
Okay, MomoCon is the best convention ever, and nobody else.
Well,
it is a convention here in Georgia at the Georgia World Congress Center, and it started off as a little, like, anime convention in the halls of Georgia Tech, and since then
went to the first one.
Yeah, I went to the first one, and it has grown exponentially. I think this year we had somewhere around 31,000 people show up.
Wow.
And that's sort of lowballing the estimates. But yeah, it's huge. It's wonderful. We're getting, where it's all about, it's not only anime anymore. It's also animation and comics and gaming. MomoCon actually has more gaming space, more gaming floor than PAX right now.
Oh, wow.
And it's sort of like, it's this hidden gem that I feel like everybody needs to know about. But I could be biased.
Yeah, full disclosure, you are part of the volunteer staff.
I am part of the volunteer staff.
Okay.
Coming from a perspective of someone who has been to MomoCon since its inception as a con goer, as an artist alley person, and then now as a vendor and a staffer, or part of the staff at least. It's pretty fucking badass.
Adana gets to hang out with Zach Callison of CD.
Yes, that was pretty cool.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's just, like, amazing just to see how much it's grown. And, I mean, they cater to a lot of different fandoms.
Mm-hmm.
Carrie says, gaming and comics as well as anime and manga.
Cool. Right, and I think one of the things which MomoCon really strives to do, which I think they do a fantastic job at, is they try to be an all-ages convention. They do a fantastic job of making sure that, you know, while they're serving all these different fandoms, it is still something that, you know, parents can feel comfortable bringing their kids to, that they don't have to, you know, be at their side at all times to make sure that they're not seeing the really...
The Lilu cosplay.
The fun comic books that some folks put out.
Yeah.
It's, I mean, a lot of people can do kind of, you know, look at it and give it sort of a side eye by saying, you know, oh, it's a family-friendly one. And one of the things I love about MomoCon is that they actually train their staff in more than just, you know, okay, you know, security, here's a radio, here's how to use it. Like, they actually talk about customer service. They legitimately have an entire, like, training day, like a training segment within all of their volunteer meetings to tell people, okay, this is how you approach volunteering at MomoCon. The volunteer staff is absolutely hands down the best run and most positive volunteer staff I have ever worked with. And again, they're so amazing. Go ahead.
As somebody who volunteered for many years for Wizard World at Philly and still has many friends who still volunteer, I have to disagree with you. The best staff is Wizard World Philly. Right, guys?
Well, we haven't been there, so
we haven't been there yet.
Agree to disagree.
Okay, all right.
Anyways, yeah, MomoCon's really great, and it is in Atlanta. So, cool. If any of your listeners are around the area, they should check it out.
Yeah, they really should.
I was going to say, so besides MomoCon, and you said HeroesCon.
Yeah, we're going to HeroesCon this weekend, so that's going to be fun.
You have any other lined up for the year?
Yes, we've got Anime Weekend Atlanta in September. We've also got the Small Press Expo that we're heading to. We were really lucky to get in through the lottery system this year, so we're excited about that. And then we're also heading to a couple animation professional conferences. One is called the Animation Conference. And the other is called Kid Screen, and so we're really looking forward to those as well.
And there's also some smaller conventions we're going to be doing here in Atlanta. There's one which runs four times a year called the Atlanta Comic Con, and that's a fantastic small convention that we're going to. And we're also going to be going to OnyxCon for the first time. That's also here in Atlanta.
I'm super looking forgot to OnyxCon too. I can't believe I forgot that.
How many onyxes can you catch there?
Well, that's a great question. We'll have to have Pokemon Go up and find out.
Yeah.
We'll verify for you.
Yeah, Maybe we'll find a Steelix in there somewhere.
Perfect.
Cool. So we're at about an hour now. So the question that we normally like to wrap up on, and we'll start with Carrie, and then we'll go around the room.
First, why don't you ask them where they can find everything? People can find everything.
I was going to do that after I ask our wrap-up question. That's how I normally do it.
I'm sorry.
After four years, you would think he would finally pay attention.
To who? I pay attention to the guests.
Okay. So, Carrie.
Yes, sir.
How do you measure success?
Oh my God! What?
I was trying to give you time to think about it. I went too early.
I guess I measure success. I guess I measure success by progress, and by what I mean by progress is, am I getting better? Is my work improving? Is the work that I create, getting new readers? Are we continuing to grow? And that's how I would measure success.
Cool. All right. How about you, Alan?
Oh, so it depends. I think Carrie's answer is quite good. I think one way that's really good to look at it is if you can get 1,000 genuine fans that are willing to give you $100 a year, that's a pretty good mark of success that you've made it. But I do really like Carrie's answer. Because I think, being able to look back at your work and see the evolution and see the progress, that's what we all want to do as artists, just, get better at our craft and, right, and have people who enjoy it.
Definitely. Cool. And how about you, Havana?
Yeah, so my answer is the same but different. So I went to Kennesaw State University, and I got to meet Damon John Speak, and he's the CEO of FUBU, the clothing line. He's also on Shark Tank. I got to ask him a question during the Q&A, and I asked him, all right, you tell us never to give up on a project. You tell us you know, no matter what, keep going. The, you know, you're going to succeed if you just keep on going. But, you know, that's not realistic for all projects. I mean, some projects, you know, unfortunately, you do have to quit. So how do you know when you actually quit? And he told me, like, when he was working on FUBU, he said, you know, if a project is no longer growing you, whether financially, whether socially, like, you know, is this project opening new doors to networking opportunities, to new people that you would have never had access to? Is it teaching you something, anything about the creative process, about business, about resilience? Is it further developing in multiple categories? And if you can say, no, it's not growing me financially, socially, business-wise, creatively, then yes, close the door. But most of the time, you know, if you're serious about a project, I mean, sometimes it's very slow. I mean, the first 2 years of Kamikaze, we didn't see a cent. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. But it opened the doors to so many people within the comics industry, within animation. I mean, we got to talk to people that I was like, I don't know how this person is, like, talking to us right now. But this is pretty cool. And then lastly, for me, the moment of success was actually going to AWA in 2015, I believe.
Yeah.
We saw someone, a friend of ours pointed someone in the crowd. When we turned around, it was a girl dressed up as Kamikaze.
Oh, cool.
And we did not, like, after we freaked out and, like, started throwing free swag at her. After, well, Carrie, Alan, is that, like, a friend of yours? Like, oh, no. Do you know her, Havana? Like, no. Like, what? She's just a stranger. It made me even more excited. So that, like, even in the hard times now, like, I'll still think back to that moment. I was like, that's pretty cool. We did that.
That's cool. True, Havana. That's true. And the cool thing about that, that cosplayer was that it was her. She saw us at MomoCon that year, which is at, over Memorial Day weekend.
Mm-hmm.
And then, at the end of September is when AWA is. So between that time, MomoCon had been her first convention ever.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
And by the time AWA rolled around, that was her second convention, and it was her first ever cosplay. And she killed it. Like, she killed it. It was so well done. So I take a lot of pride that, in the idea that, you know, we, like, she told me that it was really moving for her to be able to find a character that not only she identified with, but she felt like, you know, this is somebody I feel like I could cosplay and be, you know, really excited to cosplay. And, I take a lot of pride in that. So wow. That's a good one, Havana.
Yeah, that's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
Cool. So, as John was alluding to, the other question, just to wrap up, is where can people find you online?
Well, they can find me at Mermaid Shells on Twitter and on Instagram. But you can find the entire crew at Kamikaze Comic on Twitter.
Cool. And you can find us on Facebook at Kamikaze Animated, also on Tumblr there. You can read the comic in its entirety for free online at kamikazecomic.com. And if you want to check out our Kickstarter campaign, you'll want to go to book2, as in the number 2, .kmkz.tv. And you can get a chance to look at the Kickstarter campaign, and we'd love to have you guys look at it and maybe lend your support if you're interested.
Cool. And as always, all those links will be in the description of the episode. So
yeah,
definitely check it out.
Havana, where can we find you again?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at HavanaTweet.
Yeah.
Cool. All right.
Very good.
Well, thank you so much
for having us.
Yeah, thanks.
Yes, thank you.
That was awesome.
No, thank you.
I really appreciate you guys, like, you know, getting together last minute.
It means a lot to us.
Yeah, well, we had a great talk.
Well, we have to do our sign off first. So go ahead, Dave, do your sign off.
Wait.
Oh. See, I got this one right. I didn't ask you to do it in the beginning.
Yes, but now you've taken away the natural progression of me saying it.
Here, let me throw it to you then. So the one thing that the character doesn't seem to wear in the comic is
it's a cape. See, you don't understand. That is such an internal joke to the show. like we said, we mentioned earlier, before we started recording, unfortunately, Ben just left the show, and he used to always set me up to say the closing line with some kind of pun or some kind of comment like that. So John's taking that over now. That's why that was so funny to me.
And I'm absolutely horrible at it. Absolutely.
So on that note, boys and girls, as always, don't let your cape get caught in the door. Have a good week.